Haiti is in turmoil. What role should the U.S. play? Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Haitian President Jovenel Moïse is under fire. Thousands have taken to the streets arguing his term ended last month. His supporters say he still has a year in office. We'll get the latest. Also, what does it mean for an institution to be resilient? We're going to hear from the former president of the Rockefeller Foundation, Judith Rodin, and the new World Symphony conductor, Michael Tilson Thomas, about this idea. And finally,
it's a house party. It's just everybody's having fun on stage. It's infectious.
We return to Live from the 305, a look at the local music scene, and we introduce you to the Magic City Hippies. All of that today on Sundial. First, the news. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for joining us. There's an ongoing standoff between Haiti's president, Jovenel Moïse, and his opposition. He says his term doesn't end until next year. They claim his five-year term has expired and he should have left office earlier this month. He's accused his opponents of planning a violent coup, which they deny. This has led to arrests and protests and violence. The Miami Herald's Jacqueline Charles has been covering the situation. She joins us now. Jacqueline, always a pleasure. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
So the question is whether President Moïse's term has ended or if he has a year left. I mean, how did we get to this argument?
Well, it depends on who you ask the answer. And how did we get here? The root of this crisis is in the 2015 elections. President Michel Martelly, who was in office in 2015, he left office a year later without a successor. The reason being that the elections that were held in October of 2015 were marred by fraud allegations and civil unrest. And as a result, the elections had to be done over again, and that took basically 14 months. During that time, there was an interim provisional president who was in office. And President Moïse's detractors say that, hey, he used up the first year of your term. President Moïse says, no, he did not. The Constitution says that I have 5 years and I started in 2017. But the Constitution also says that the clock started ticking on that five-year term when the previous president steps down. So we're looking at a constitutional crisis, but it really is about a larger political crisis in Haiti, a governance issue, and the question of who's in charge.
Have the courts spoken up about this?
Haiti does not have a constitutional court because every president who was in charge, who was supposed to put a constitutional court in place, did not do so. And the Supreme Court has not said anything, but we have heard from a lot of different jurists, including the Bar Federation of Haiti, that basically has sided with the opposition civil society groups that said that the president's term expired on February 7th of this year. The United States, the UN, and the OAS Secretary General, of course, they disagree and they agree with President Moïse and they say that he has a year left.
So there was an alleged plot to overthrow him. What happened? First of all, who's leading that group and you know, what happened?
Well, I like to use the word alleged. President Moïse on February 7th, instead of stepping down, he announced that some 20 plus individuals were arrested in an alleged plot to overthrow and to kill him. These individuals were arrested in the middle of the night, 2:59 a.m. to be exact, according to the interview that I did with one of the individuals who was arrested, a Supreme Court judge. And they were literally in their pajamas when the palace security came into this residential development, stormed it, fired tear gas, and had everybody come out and rounded them up. And most of them are still in jail today, with the exception of this former Supreme Court judge, who, by the way, was fired by President Moïse after this arrest.
All right. And this judge, this particular judge, you spoke with him, right?
Yes, I did an interview with him yesterday. He says he's innocent. He says the whole thing was a setup. He says, what coup d'etat? They caught me, you know, in bed while I'm sleeping. The guns that they claimed that we had belonged to my Haitian National Police security detail, who, by the way, have also been arrested. He denies any involvement in any sort of coup. You know, the individuals still haven't been able to really go before a judge. It's a mess. I mean, in response to all of this, Several judges' associations have announced an indefinite shutdown of the judiciary in Haiti. So today, if you get arrested in Haiti, prepare to be in jail for a while because the courthouses are closed.
Is there any reason to believe that the U.S. or any other Western country is involved in this in any way? I mean, we just think about, you know, the U.S.'s very long history in intervening in disputes.
Involved in the alleged coup or involved in the current crisis?
Well, you know what? That's a good question. I guess, I mean, how, because you just said a moment ago, like the U.S. basically is saying that they're backing President Moïse, but we don't have any reason to believe that they may be possibly backing the alleged coup.
Well, I raised that question because in the conversation I had with the judge and after the arrest, there were a lot of speculation about what may have happened. And one of the things that was dangled out there was that some of these individuals who were arrested believed that they were on a State Department sanctioned mission. And so we heard the name of a former U.S. State Department employee who allegedly was making contact with some of the individuals who were arrested. I reached out to that employee. He denies all of this. He hasn't been in Haiti 2001. He says it's a case of impersonation. He doesn't even know how he got pulled into this saga. So that is one issue. But overall, in terms of the U.S., there is pressure on the Biden administration. Remember, President Biden, when he was campaigning, he came to Little Haiti in October. 3 weeks later, actually 18 days to be exact, he went on Twitter. He criticized President Trump at the time, accused him of ignoring Haiti while that country's political paralysis was deepening. Today, the paralysis is even worse than it was in October. And people are calling President Biden out on that and says, hey, we haven't seen any difference in your policy from what existed when Trump was in power. They want the U.S. to step up. They want the U.S. to do more instead of just supporting Moïse as they see it. You know, the view is that the U.S. has been very dismissive toward Haiti's opposition and civil society groups. It has not really taken seriously their arguments in respect to the constitution issue, but their overall frustration about the governance of the country, the ration kidnappings, the widening insecurity. Instead, what they hear from the United States is you have to go to elections. But no one from the U.S. side has said, how do you have elections in a country where you have armed gangs running rampant? You have a lack of trust in the electoral system, a lack of trust in democracy. How do you pull that off?
Yeah. Again, talking with the Miami Herald's Jacqueline Charles, we're talking about Haiti's ongoing constitutional crisis, a fight about whether President Jovenel Moïse's term has ended or whether he still has a year left in office. Again, you can find more of her in-depth reporting on this on our social media at WLRN Sundial. Jacqueline, there have been marches. They started peaceful. Some violence did break out. How are the people of Haiti reacting right now? And are there more marches scheduled?
Yes, there are more protests planned. We saw one on Sunday, which was huge, and it was in response to the U.S. government, who basically said it's remarkable how, you know, the opposition hasn't been able to get people out because Haitians are tired of lockdowns and power grabs. But Haitians really do feel today that the country is going backward, that it's falling into a dictatorship. President Moïse has been ruling by decree for over a year, meaning he is just one of 11 elected officials in this country of 11 million people. He has issued a number of executive orders that are very worrisome, to the point that the State Department just this week, the Assistant Secretary there for Western Hemisphere, issued a tweet about this, some of these unilateral and undemocratic moves. But what we have seen with the protests is that the police have become increasingly aggressive. A number of journalists have been injured. They have been tear gassed by officers. And we are increasingly seeing an attack on the civic space. So this is very worrisome at this point.
You know, it was interesting. I remember we had a panel conversation you were on about the 10-year commemoration of the Haiti earthquake. And I'm wondering, how did that disaster from a decade ago still have implications on the politics today?
You know, I mean, you think about this disaster and all that was destroyed and the number of lives that were lost, more than 300,000, you know, and this whole slogan about building back better. And we can say that Haiti has not built back better. Out of that disaster, you saw an election, and that also was a chaotic election. There were problems in that election. And I would say that 10 years later, we are still seeing the ramifications of that election. I mean, when you look at U.S. policy in Haiti, you go from either strong arm tactics where the U.S. is heavily involved in putting a lot of pressure on a president, to we've seen during the Trump administration where they're sort of hands off and, you know, not really that involved in paying attention. So, you know, where do you find that medium, what needs to be done. And Haitians themselves don't really know the answer. On the one hand, you know, they resent the implication of the United States, the UN, and other in the international community in their domestic politics. But at the same time, they are looking to the international community to come and save the day.
I wanted to ask you about this. This week was Carnival, and the annual pre-Lent celebrations were canceled in like Brazil, Trinidad, Tobago, because of the pandemic. But Haiti, they went on with their celebrations. I mean, the photos of big crowds, no masks. It's almost like maybe the pandemic is non-existent. I mean, what does the country's Ministry of Health have to say about what happened?
So among Haitians, you know, there's this joke or there's this feeling says, you know, COVID doesn't exist in Haiti, right? I mean, it's amazing when you look at some of the daily activities, you don't see people with masks. And after 2 years of not having Carnival, we saw that Carnival was put on in Haiti. I have to tell you, in Haiti, Carnival has been used kind of like as a political tool to appease the population whenever the country is knee deep in a political crisis. So, you know, you don't give them bread, you give them Carnival, right? And so you saw this, and then to the point that the Bahamas basically issued a temporary travel ban for 21 days for anybody coming from Haiti. It says, you know what, you cannot come to the Bahamas because we've been, struggling with our own COVID infection numbers, and we don't want you to come and to contribute to any sort of spike. The Ministry of Health, I mean, I reached out to them. I asked them because there was a stand there. They said that they were basically doing health education. They don't have an opinion or a say-so in whether or not Carnival takes place or not. They are a government agency, but they were doing health education about, you know, the use of preventing transmittable diseases. There was a big banner that reminded people that the coronavirus was still very much a concern. But yes, those images were shocking to a lot of people. And people are still like amazed that in the rest of this region where Carnival has been canceled, the show still went on in Haiti.
What do we know about the infection rate right now in Haiti?
Well, you know, so Haiti is an interesting story, right? Because at the onset of COVID-19, almost a year ago this March, I mean, it was gloom and doom. The predictions were that, you know, at best case scenario, Haiti may see 20,000 dead. And Haiti has not seen it. They've seen maybe about 200. And even when you acknowledge the limitations that the country has with testing, what we have seen in Haiti is that people have not been getting sick, deathly ill from COVID-19 that we've seen in the United States or even next door in the Dominican Republic. I mean, even when people get COVID, they survive it, they do well. I mean, the people who have passed on have been mostly older people with some sort of, you know, comorbidity or something. And so this has actually, you know, plagued scientists, right? They want to know what's going on. You know, is it the weather? Is it that Haitians are drinking their teas? Like, what is it about Haiti that COVID-19 just hasn't had the impact there that we've seen else in other places? And I have to tell you, Haiti's not the only place. Also, there are countries in Africa, the same thing, that we are not seeing the numbers of deaths that were initially predicted. And the health ministry told me yesterday too, as much as we're talking, we're concerned about these three variants that are out there, there is not yet any evidence that any of these variants exist in Haiti.
I wanted to finish up with this. You mentioned it earlier. You mentioned the kidnappings, and I wondered, you know, if that's still an issue there, and what is the government even saying about it?
The kidnappings is truly an issue. I mean, just today I was listening to one of the local news programs there, and the brother of a judge was kidnapped. And I've seen reports today that the population where he's originally from, they've shut down the roadways demanding that he be freed. You know, everybody is vulnerable. I mean, it's the poor prying on the poor. We've seen, you know, students, children, older people, people who work in markets. I mean, and people who don't have a lot of money, and these kidnappers, usually armed gangs, they're asking for a lot of money. I mean, we finally had President Jovenel during a national address say something about it. But, you know, from all of my reporting, what I've been seeing is that people are not being freed because the police are going in and, you know, and grabbing these hostages. They're being freed because families are having to empty out their life savings in a lot of cases to pay ransoms in order to get people out. And that is a huge issue, especially at a time when the U.S. and others are pushing this whole idea of elections. Yeah. Is that in a country where you have rampant kidnappings, widening insecurity, how do you pull off a vote in this kind of atmosphere?
Yep. Well, an ongoing story. And of course, we'll keep up with you to keep our listeners up to date on what's happening. Again, Miami Herald's Jacqueline Charles. Check out her in-depth reporting on this on our social media at WLRN Sundial. Jacqueline, always a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
All right. Still to come. What does it mean to be resilient? We're going to get perspective from leaders in the world of philanthropy and classical music. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. For 34 years, New World Symphony has trained musicians from around the globe and become a premier arts institution in the U.S. Dozens of fellows trained under the guidance of artistic director and conductor Michael Tilson Thomas, who was recently given the Kennedy Center Honors for Lifetime Achievement. Now, this year, the symphony was forced to adapt in many ways because of the pandemic. On Saturday, the annual gala will be entirely virtual and feature performances from cellist Yo-Yo Ma and violinist Gil Shaham. The theme of the gala is resilience, something NWS board member and gala chair Judith Roden knows all too well. As the former president of the Rockefeller Foundation and the first woman to be president of an Ivy League school, she's dedicated her life to understanding the challenges organizations face and developing strategies for them to survive and evolve. WLRN editorial director Alicia Zuckerman spoke with Michael Tilson Thomas and Judith Roden last week.
I wanted to start off talking about the idea of what New World Symphony is in terms of the Orchestral Academy. And a large part of what New World Symphony is fellowship and the idea of fellowship, being together, growing together as musicians, forging friendships. How are you handling your role? And both of you feel free to answer this. How are you handling your role in trying to make sure that this fellowship still happens when being together in person is actually can be dangerous right now?
The shape of our world this year has been that there have been about 20 or so fellows who've continued to live in the lovely apartments they have on South Beach throughout the whole summer and during the whole beginning of the fall. The rest of the 50 plus members were everywhere in the world, all over the United States and indeed across the Pacific and in Europe and all manner of places. So it's been a mixture of the fellows who were remaining in Miami coming up with their own strategies, such as the program Live from Our Living Room, which was their own put together concert series that they did from their communal space in their residence area. And also a lot of individual coachings with people all over the world. Some of those were one-on-one. In a few cases, they were ensembles. There were also master classes being done by members of the great orchestras of the world who would gather 12 or 14 fellows at a time on a Zoom call and have everybody kind of compare the way that they played various passages and get helpful hints about musical and technical ideas. So everyone has applied himself in very ingenious ways to keeping as much spontaneous and progressive contact between us all.
Judith Roden, you're an expert in the realm of resilience as a concept, and one of your books is called The Resilience Dividend, Being Strong in a World Where Things Go Wrong. Back when you first started thinking about this, what were the things that go wrong that were on your mind that spurred this interest in resilience as a concept?
At the time when we began working on it, I was the president of the Rockefeller Foundation, and we were working in places all around the world, and we saw the accelerating typhoons and floods and hurricanes and all of the things that were induced by climate change really growing and challenging both development and progress, but also really challenging how we would think about the future. It became clear that climate change, as existential a threat as it was and is, wasn't the only crisis that was occurring, that we were seeing economic crises, we were seeing social crises. And we began to understand that in the 21st century, it may be that crisis is the new normal. And so the work on resilience is really about preparing for what you can prepare for in advance, but also developing the capacity that allows you to bounce back more quickly from crises when they occur. Not every disruption really has to become a disaster. And then importantly, to transform and grow. Often when we're in crisis, we say, oh, I wish things would just get back to normal. But normal, in fact, may have components within it that made you more vulnerable to the effects of the crisis in the first place. So it's this growth and transformation, as well as the capacity to bounce back at the moment, that really is at the heart of resilience and makes it so important, and of course, made it unbelievably relevant during last year.
So knowing what you know and learning what you've learned, how are you applying that in the role that you're in now to, as far as it relates to New World Symphony?
Well, I'm only a board member, so I would say it's really the maestro and the staff who have been quite extraordinary in enabling the fellows to really develop the skills of resilience that they needed during this period. But the real concern during part of this period, among several of them, that they wouldn't be allowed back in the country. So we all work together.
Yeah, you know, it's been a time of, you know, I think really a lot of despair for a lot of people and a lot of loss, you know, big losses and small losses. I kind of want to think about how you've sort of mitigated that sense of despair. And MTT, maybe you can talk about what you've seen in your experiences with the musicians as you've gotten to know them in a way that's really different than the way you've had a chance to get to know them in previous years. What are some of those moments for you where you sort of feel that sense of despair getting conquered?
I'm not a person who dwells on despair. All of us experience these things in our lives and our families' lives, but I come from a family that kind of reinvented itself in many different countries in many challenging situations 100 or so years ago. And in my own life and work, I have both initially invented myself long ago, a certain idea of myself and the work that I was doing, and then over the years, constantly reinventing.
When you talk about adaptation and reinvention, your grandparents were stars of the Yiddish theater. They had come over from Eastern Europe, and that was sort of maybe the beginning of your family's history in performance.
Yes, I mean, to really condense it to its most basic fundamentals, they were in the Ukraine after the assassination of Alexander II, and lots of people who were considered suspect were basically told that they had 24 hours, if that, to pack themselves up and get out of there, or else be conscripted the guys into the army for the rest of their lives, which meant for Jews, death, basically. So they just had to get out of there, get themselves to the United States, and create an entirely different life, which in their case was a life in the theater, which became a very influential theater, culturally, intellectually, socially. And they did this, particularly my grandmother. She became a very celebrated actress. And then when they split up, when he was 40-something and she was in her later 30s, she again reinvented herself as now a comedian, whereas she'd been playing tragedy before then, built an entirely new career, an entirely new repertoire, her own chain of theaters and production companies and publishing companies. And she did all of this in about 1916 or so, a remarkable thing for a woman to do at that point. As she used to say, with just a fourth grade education. So this process has really been to for me to try and share with lots of young people that this is a process of what happens in life, what happens in the life of an artist, and that thinking about resilience is not about thinking to going back to the good old days. It's about really imagining new great days in the future that will be shaped by what we have learned about the fundamentals of our art and its ability to communicate and share during this time. You know, the thing that an actor, in fact, I come from a family of actors, learns very early on that it depends very much how you present yourself according to the size audience you are addressing. So people who hold forth on, let's say, opera stages, that's part of being an actor, part of show business, where you're kind of singing to a hall with many thousands of seats, that's a certain kind of declamatory, projected kind of presentation. If you're an actor doing a Harold Pinter play in a smaller theater, that's an entirely different kind of presentation. Some of the sessions that I've had during this year, the one-on-one coaching sessions, have been quite different from the experience of working with somebody in the same room, for example, which is mostly what I've done. Somehow, if you're online with just one other person, you're really working on ideas of phrasing and musicality and whatnot, it takes you to a place which I'm imagining might be much like what confession could be like, that it's both a musical and a personal thing. It somehow leads itself into a lot more about how people are feeling about the music, how confident they feel about being able to project the message of the music, how much part of their work at this time is to recognize the inspirational messages which are in the music and how to apply those to their own life.
I'm Alicia Zuckerman. I'm speaking with New World Symphony Artistic Director Michael Tilson-Thomas and board member Judith Roden. She's co-chair of this year's virtual gala for the Orchestral Academy. The New World Symphony Gala is happening this Saturday online. You can find out more information about that on our social media at WLRN Sundial. I just love thinking about fast forwarding and imagining what the musicians who are going through this experience right now, what that will yield artistically. I love thinking about that.
One thing we're here to talk about today is this amazing gala we have coming up. And that is itself a remarkable testimony to the kind of fellowship, the kind of family that the New World Symphony has created, not only amongst its thousands of fellows who are now alums and are in great ensembles all over the world and work with us as mentors and teachers, but also quite extraordinary artists, including Renee Fleming, Yefim Bronfman, Manuel Axe, Yo-Yo Ma, Gil Shaham, Jean-Yves Thibaudet, the McGill brothers, Anthony and Damari McGill, and some of our great alums like Teddy Abrams, who's probably the most visionary music director of any orchestra in the country right now, the work he's been doing with the Louisville Orchestra in these last years. So this is quite a lineup of people to be with us and exchange their thoughts and perspectives on how the New World Symphony has contributed to their lives, not only in the way that they have interacted and taught and mentored our fellows, but in many cases, they have used the New World Symphony also as a way of expanding their own horizons. Many of them have chosen to do major pieces for the first time in their lives with us. We have a little more time to rehearse and consider and, as I'm very fond of saying, mull things over. We are not in a civilization anymore that in which mulling things over is a much known or treasured process. And I have this feeling that some of the greatest ideas in civilization probably were achieved by mulling things over.
I want to make sure we have a chance to talk about one of the innovations that happened as a result of moving into the new building 10 years ago now, the internet too. And I wondered, I was thinking a lot as it became clear how hard it is especially for musicians right now, and because of the delay factor online, it's real like performing in unison or performing as a group together is very, very difficult. And I wonder how much having that capacity of the internet too and has helped you out.
Not only the use of internet too, which of course over the next several years will be available so much more widely, but you talked earlier about the loss of something when the fellows aren't all together. But there's also something they gain when they have to communicate when they're not all together. New ways of collaboration are emerging, I think, at this moment, musically, not just in terms of, you know, you have an idea, I have an idea, let's collaborate, but the ways the instruments are interacting with one another is different because they're the need to perform differently, to listen differently, to appreciate differently is driving something that's new and exciting.
Before we wrap up, I did want to ask you both to think about before the pandemic, you know, what you've been through in your life that really required calling on this sense of adaptation, survival, resilience, in a way that's showing up now in what's required of you in this moment in your respective roles?
Michael and I are the same age. We've been through so many ups and downs in our life. And I think each one of them has made us stronger. I'm a psychologist, and in some of my early work was working on the development of coping skills. And it's really interesting, the people who don't cope well as adults with challenges and crises are those who coasted through success after success after success. It's why so many university freshmen who have been at the top of their classes really collapse when they get to college because they've never failed, they've never gotten a C. I've gotten lots of bumps in my life. I've been the first woman this and the first woman that of many, many things. And it wasn't always easy. So I feel well prepared for this moment. And I'm glad to be here to have to confront it. I have a lot of friends who are no longer living. And I think it makes you very grateful for every additional year you have, no matter what that year brings.
I have an idea. Instead of my saying anything, would you play Elaine Stritch's recording of I'm Still Here?
I think we can make that happen.
That would express more completely and perfectly anything that I could say, I think.
Good times and bum times, I've seen them all, and my dear, I'm still here. Plush velvet sometimes, sometimes just pretzels and beer, but I'm here. I've stuffed the dailies in my shoes.
That was Judith Rodin, New World Symphony board member and former president of the Rockefeller Foundation and the University of Pennsylvania. Also, Michael Tilson Thomas, artistic director of the symphony. They spoke with our editorial director, Alicia Zuckerman. You can find more about Saturday's virtual gala on our social media at WLRN Sundial. Well, still to come, let's get you up and dancing. Magic City Hippies are in our next series live from the 305. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Magic City Hippies are on a mission to get people up and dancing. I don't know, you feel it right now, I am. The trio started with inauspicious beginnings after graduating from the University of Miami, playing dive bars in Coconut Grove back in 2011. Their indie pop style and groovy rhythms have garnered them international popularity, playing major festivals from Lollapalooza to Bonnaroo. Last year, they released their first full-length album, Modern Animal. Now, we spoke with the band members Robbie Hunter, John Coughlin, and Pat Howard about the evolution of the group as part of our series Live from the 305. And by the way, you can see photos and videos on WLRN's Instagram and on our Facebook and Twitter. Take me back to when you were playing at the Barracuda Bar and Grill in Coconut Grove. And sadly, I think it's the pandemic has shut it down, at least for now. But tell me what life was like for you back then. And what were your ambitions? What did you think, you know, you were going to do?
You know, I think ultimately I was just kind of like frustrated with not being able to play music for anybody. So I just kind of was like, you know, screw it. I'll just play music on the street. And, you know, I love the Grove. So I would just go there and play music on the street and climb up the Caldwell Bank Center and plug in my extension cord and just, you know, have at it. And I think, you know, people dug it until there was like five cops that came and they're like, we're gonna shut this down. But yeah, I mean, that was the beginning. And then, you know, I got introduced to Pat for one gig at the Barracuda Bar, and John came along, and the rest is history, really.
So wait a second, Pat, you were doing what? You were an electrical engineer, right?
I mean, I've been playing drums since I was 6 years old. I think it was just something I was just trying to stay pragmatic, you know, maybe for my parents or just, I don't know. I was just like, the information I got was very encouraging, a lot of, you know, positive feedback about my ability at music, but it was always like, yeah, but that's, you know, that's a hobby, don't like go study that. And, you know, I got to the point of kind of making the decision for myself later on. It just, you know, it's just something you can't steer away from forever.
John, when did you come into the picture? How did that happen?
So yeah, me and Pat was studying at UM Music School together, and towards the end of college, I'd moved into this house that ended up becoming the Hippie Castle, and I knew Pat kind of loosely, so I invited him in, and it was like summer, we're 20, you know, absolutely nothing to do, no money, and I'm just sitting around, and he was going to go play a gig with Robbie, and I met Robbie maybe once or twice. This is like all within a year period, right? And I was like, Pat, I would love to come play with you guys. You know, he wasn't like, hey man, like we need a bass player, because they're just doing duo at that point. But I was like, you know, like I'm down, you know, like I would do this I have nothing to do on a Thursday. And at that point, it was very much this project, you know, I mean, the live side was just a good time thing. It wasn't like rehearsed. It didn't have a direction necessarily. But at the same time, it was this project that started as like Robbie's writing songs and Pat's like the producer. So it's very deferential to what Pat wanted. I was like, I can play bass. Just like, tell me what you want. Right. So you know, and he told me, he's like, I don't want any bass players. I need a very focused person who's going to serve the music. So I would show up, right? And I played the gig, and I wouldn't even play the first minute of the song because there's no rehearsals. I didn't even know the songs. They would just start playing, and I would close my eyes, be like, wait, that's it. And I would start playing, and I could tell that just kind of clicked right away. So that was kind of, you know, the live thing. In the studio, you know, our studio was in Pat's room at the castle, so that's a very different thing. I actually played guitar on all of our records, but I was playing bass live at the time, so it's a very interesting arrangement.
And Rob, I mean, when did you know, like, all right, this could turn into something. This is a group.
You know, playing at the tail end of our Barracuda Bar days, where we would just like pack it, and then we started playing other gigs and stuff, and we were getting regular gigs. We did play a lot with Prism. You know, shout out to Prism, they're awesome. It was a thing that was happening. There was just a lot of attention, and a lot of people would come out to see our shows, you know. And then once the music started coming together, and we popped out this song Hard On Me and Corazon, it was special. You know, you knew that there was something there, some magic there, and we just kept going, and, you know, here we are.
You know, I mean, you think about Miami and the kind of music that comes out of this town, but I'm wondering, like, when you guys were starting, What was the scene like for the alternative indie party rock? I mean, what was going on?
Miami has slow, you know, ever before COVID, but Miami has slowly, the scene has slowly been increasing and like diversifying. And I think, you know, there's just like this huge vacuum, you know, there's just there's a market for it. People want live music here, and the turnover of venues is so high, you know, where you have like incredible venues like The Stage and Wheel Call, all these places, Grand Central, that are gone now. And that's sad, you know, but still the demand for live music is so high in Miami that I think it's creating these little like subgenres that are popping up, which kind of like allows us to do whatever we want. You know, I don't know what our genre is exactly. You know, we just kind of make whatever music we want. Yeah,
there's a lot of room.
Yeah.
I mean, it's kind of, I guess people could say this about any music scene in any city in the world or whatever, where it's like suddenly, you know, a couple of years into being serious about it, you kind of know everybody there. Yeah. Every scene can seem small. But I remember coming down here and like, it was crazy eventually to get to know, there were names that preceded themselves. Like, you're obviously like Spam All Stars and Afro Beta and, you know, Elastic Bond and all the local bands that are had a little bit more of the Miami flavor, like Artificial and all that. I think when we were first starting, that was kind of, those were the bands that were gigging around town. And I don't know, I think here with everybody else.
And I think for the live scene, we just found this middle ground that wasn't very occupied, where like we weren't like a clean like top 40 wedding band. You know, we weren't professional necessarily. But we weren't like a like heavy rock band playing Churchill's either. You know, it was we weren't either of those things. And you know, when it came to if you're wanting to go out and drink, like we kind of found a good like happy medium, entertaining with people, but still people would be like, you guys are a rock band. You know, people actually like looked at it as something that wasn't just like, oh, we're a group of guys dressed up who get paid good money to come do this every night. You know,
good money.
Yeah. We got paid in good beer every night. That's about it.
So, I mean, so John, is it, was it when like Fanfare and Corazon came out? Is that when you guys kind of started breaking out of just the local scene? Is that when all of a sudden you were getting that attention, you know, nationally and beyond?
I would say there's always been a duality between the live thing and the recorded music, because the recorded music took off, you know, on its, not necessarily by itself, but using, you know, the blogosphere of 2013 or whatever, and getting on the hype machine. So the recorded music that we've just made without being necessarily even be able to play it live, we just like made it in the studio, that took a life of its own. And then the live thing was slower coming up, kind of behind that, you know.
We didn't know how to play, like we released, so we were Robbie Hunter Band, right, in 2013, and our album was called Magic City Hippies, but we already had some hype machine buzz out that we were afraid of like losing. We're like, we can't change the band name now, like this would ruin everything.
We're the biggest we'll ever be. Right.
So
now
we just stuck right, exactly, we're just like, we stuck with Robbie Hunter Band until, and so that was the record that had Hard on Me and Corazon and all that. And then we didn't decide to make the leap to change the band name until 2015 with the EP, and that was with Fanfare.
Reefer, you know, Reefer Madness. A city starved of fame. It's the same old thing. Yes, lean with me, rock with me. The mug and B side, deep fry, and greet lie, clam baked by the seaside. 10 legs wearing knee highs, sand shakes off their sweet thighs. Back in 99 when I was Silver Spoon Fair, pops at the publisher, doling out the bread. John's on the salsa, going against his head. I got divorce, yeah, cold as a course, but
then. And yeah, like I remember we had like a release party for the Robbie Hunter Band album in 2013 we played at Barracudas. That's and we right. Couldn't play a single song off it, except maybe Corazon, because it's such a studio thing. Like, I'm playing bass on the records, we're all handing around a guitar, we were exploring kind of the studio more as an instrument.
We had the technical ability to play. Yeah. It. I'm not saying we couldn't play the things we recorded, but we were just this like rock and roll three piece, and we were making these songs that had multiple guitar parts, keys, some horns, you know, trying to deliver that when you're playing on like a, you know, 3-foot by 6-foot stage in the corner of the Barracuda, which we love, you know. we played after one of the Heat, like the game 7 or they won the championship at the Cuda, and I'll never, that's when I thought we were really killing it. Just the energy from the show, but there was everyone was just loving the music. I was like, this is amazing. And then the next show, no one came to, you know. But
I'm speaking with Robbie Hunter, John Coughlin, and Pat Howard. They make up the band Magic City Hippies. They're part of Season 3 of Live from the 305. You can see photos and video on our social media at WLRN Sundial.
You know, and that's interesting then, like the difference between, you know, being in the studio and on stage. And I'm wondering for you guys, what is it that makes, you know, Magic City Hippie live show really unique, considering what fans in South Florida want?
It's a house party, you know. It's a full-on party, and it just feels like you're there, you know. It feels very personal. It's just everybody's having fun on stage. It's infectious, you know. And we want to just bring that to every show. All around the country, we do the same thing. And so I feel like, yeah, it's contagious. Like, you can feel it. The energy is there, you know.
Especially if you're playing original music for people that, you know, if you're especially playing in South Florida, you know, a lot of people are looking to be entertained and dance and stuff like that. And, you know, threading the needle of, like, I wrote this and they're dancing to it is, like, kind of hard. Because even some of our best favorite bands in Miami, if you go to see them, they're like, original music isn't necessarily the thing that you can see is moving people the most. It's like they can nail that cover or this arrangement they have or something. So it feels very, we feel very lucky that the random music that came out of our brains also is music that people want to, like, move to.
Yeah. And, you know, John, I was thinking about, like, you know, the your latest album, Modern Animal, came out just before this pandemic hit. Tell me a little bit about, you know, the inspiration for this one, because you think about, you know, the dance grooves that you've got going on, mixing it up with some pop melodies. I mean, what was behind this one? What were you guys trying to do?
Well, this was our first full-length Magic City Hippie, and as you know, they always say your first record is about everything that happened up to you in that moment, you know, and then everything else, you have, like, your set.
It doesn't feel that way. I didn't like them leaning into the word debut for when we were, like, promoting it, because, you know, we had an LP, and we're the same people, we just, like, finally decided to change the name. So, in our real creative, like, you know, brotherhood, that Robbie Hunter Band album was, like, our debut LP, and then there's an EP in between, and then Modern Animal, but yeah, I guess under the moniker Magic City Hippies, that would have been the debut album. I think the live thing kind of folded back and informed that album a little more, because we had been touring for 2 years, mm-hmm. trying to finish that record, dragging some songs that we had started before that along with us, and touring. Like, we were out on the road with this band Hippocampus from the Twin Cities for like 2.5 months. We did like 47 shows or something. Two, three of the guys in the band had never seen snow before, and it was a winter tour, like, yeah.
First show in Fargo,
North America.
Yeah. Yeah, bunch of Miami boys.
First show was in Fargo, North Dakota.
Jam-packed in a Buick Enclave.
But a lot more big, you know, guitars and, like, blown-out drums, I think, made their way onto it. It was like there's a little more rock and, like, funk moments, because we just realized we like digging in on that, whereas in the studio, maybe you don't always, you know, it's, like, late at night and, you know, we spark something up, or
you're like, this is so beautiful. The song
tempos tend to come down, but, like, if we remember the live aspect, it tends to lead another direction.
Yeah, that's really important to us, is that the live show is like a rock show. It's just something that you spend enough time on the road, and you're like, even in the just a funk, kind of cruising along song, the thing we're going for live is a lot closer to, like, you know, at least for me, like AC/DC. I'm imagining I'm running around in, like, a little kid's car, you know, like, doing, I don't know, I just feel like what we do live is you're trying to, like, melt faces. You know, it really is this, like, you see, I guess, some good video I get to live back and watch, and you see these kids are just like, you know, you see their mouths slow. I know this is not going to be with video. You see their mouths slowly open, their eyes get bigger, and they tap their friend on the shoulder, and they go, did you see that? You know, like, that aspect of it is something that I think from our meets before Modern Animal was something we were only experiencing live, but on Modern Animal, we managed to take that and put it on the record, kind of get that lightning in a bottle somehow. That was a big goal for us, I think, in that record.
Well, I mean, Rob, what was it like then when everything stopped and you had to stop touring, and you know you can't get that experience right now?
Yeah, it's been brutal. You know, I think just as it has been for everybody else whose life has stopped, you know, whose dreams are put on hold. I mean, everybody feels it. You know, us too. You know, and we were so blessed and lucky to finish this last tour right before the pandemic stopped everything. And it was our most successful tour. We just got so lucky. And, you know, right now, I think kind of like a lot of other bands, we're just huddling together in the studio trying to crank out, you know, another piece of music, another album. And that's all you can do, you know, get ready for when this thing clears up and we can go back out again, but we don't even know when that's going to be right now. So
yeah, I mean, do you guys talk about like when you think, because little by little we see sporting events and other big events starting to open up to crowds, but small crowds. Do you guys talk about like when you think you might be able to do some live, maybe safely? I don't know. What's going through your mind?
Yeah. Well, we're pretty lucky in that, you know, with the whole structure of being in a band, you have album cycles, right? So every couple of years you go through a whole thing where it's like writing, videos, release, tour, and then it starts back over, right? And for us, like it all, you know, we're very blessed, and there's a lot of people suffering around like that. I want to name that, right? And for us, you know, we're at home when we were supposed to have been at home at the same time. We're working on a new record that's going swimmingly, in my opinion, because we're kind of stuck at home just to make it. And so, like, there's so many bands that we know are friends or our label or our management mates, people we share management with, who depend on the road. They need to be on the road all year long to make their money. And for us, like, it has been, you know, ironically, a pretty nurturing environment to be making what I think is our best music yet.
That was Robbie Hunter, John Coughlin, and Pat Howard of the indie rock trio Magic City Hippies. Check out their latest releases, Modern Out, Animal, and see photos and video of the group on our social media. Live from the 305 at WLRN Sundial. And hey, if you're a South Florida-based group that we should be checking out as part of the Live from the 305, hit us up, sundial at WLRNnews.org. That's our program for this Thursday, February 18th. Have a great Friday, a wonderful weekend. Stay safe, be good to each other, as I always say. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks for listening. We'll talk to you again live on Monday.